Well, hello everybody, this is Tim Green with Rattled Magazine. Welcome to Rattlecast number 80. Today's guest is Rebecca Stark. She's on the line. We'll get to her in just a minute. Before we begin, I should say that Rattle's a publication of the Rattle Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit working to promote the practice of poetry. We've been in continuous publication since 1995 and are unaffiliated with any other organization. We just do this because we love poetry, and I know you love poetry because you're here watching on a cold and snowy night, probably. And if you do, please click the like button and share, and make sure you're subscribed anywhere we are on social media or on video apps, wherever you're listening to this later. On iTunes, give us a star rating. Whatever you can do to click something helps us out a lot. I should also say, for any new people who are watching tonight live, we do have an open mic show at the second hour. So after an hour with Rebecca, we'll be going to the open lines. So think about something you'd like to share. You can share a poem of your own. You can share a poem you love. The prompt this week was to write a poem about an encounter with a stranger. So if you have a poem about that and it wasn't prepared, but you can still send it in. I'll give you the numbers later to join us on the open mic. But for now, you can just send a poem if you'd like to share one to open mic, openmic at rattle.com at any time during the show. And if you're not here, we could also read a poem for you. Priority goes to new callers and people who are here. But if we have time, I can read poems too. So send some poems on along. Now, as I mentioned, Rebecca Starks is today's guest. And Rebecca is the author of two books from Able Muse Press. I'll put the one that's out on screen right now. That is Time Is Always Now from Able Muse Press. It just came out last year. Her other book is Fetch Muse, which is forthcoming from Able Muse Press. Rebecca is the winner of the 2018 Neil Postman Award for Metaphor for her poem Open Carry, which you can find on our Facebook page and stuff right now, actually, at the top. And she's also founding editor of Mud Season Review. She lives in Richmond, Vermont, and here she is, Rebecca Starks. Hey, Rebecca, how you doing?
Hi, good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. So, first of all, how are you doing tonight? I know there's storms brewing all over the place. Are you? I noticed the wonderful log cabin you have back there.
Yeah, well, we're glad the power didn't go out. The kids were home from school, so they had a fun day in the snow.
Yeah. And you're, is it rural where you live? You describe it as a cabin in the woods.
Yeah. It seems rural. We can't see any neighbors. But just about 6 minutes down the road is a town. I mean, you know, it's a town of 4,000 people, but then about half an hour to Burlington, which feels now like the big city. I've kind of gone smaller and smaller in my life, from New York City to Portland, Oregon. And
Do you want to start us out with a poem?
Yeah, I thought I'd start with one. A good friend and poet of mine thought this was a pandemic poem now. I wrote it actually as a poem of trying to have a second child, and but it feels now sort of appropriate for this time. Only child. Sorry, it's on page 73. Only child. The first spring, Andy cleared the vines that gave the tree its only green, some 12 feet high and never pruned. It sprouted simple, unlobed leaves. We watched their light green glow unfold in delicate tongues with curled tips along a few weak, rain-soaked boughs bent like whips of forsythia. The second they had begun to bunch, and crowd enough we had no qualms twisting sprigs from the longest branch to test our local nurseries and arborists we hoped could tell its Latin or its common name. But dove-like, we returned each time, embellished by new ignorance. Still Andy's suspicion, fruit tree bearing no fruit, until that fall, unshaded by its canopy, a large green pear, rock-hard, appeared bare on the ground with broken stem, while in the tree no sign of pears, but one torn white strip on a limb, where this one might have hung unseen. Had some young boy like Augustine returned it with remorse, lobbed it over the wrong fence, giving us this mistaken April hope of more? Or had the tree spent all on this, revived devotion pushing forth more than a season's growth supports? It kept unripened for a year.
Thanks so much. And that was Only Child from the book that's available now, Time Is Always Now, by Rebecca Starks. Rebecca, do you want to describe a little bit what the title means? The time is always now. How did you for this first book? Think of constructing it and putting together the poems as a manuscript. And how did the themes emerge?
Well, that title suggestion came from someone else, from Maggie Smith, actually, who looked at the manuscript for me. And it came from a line from a poem that you published, actually, Politicians. It was one that one of the Poets Respond poems. And she felt, and as soon as she pointed it out, that I could really read each poem against that as a lens. I mean, in terms of issues with the climate, political issues, just life in general. It became the way of tying together poems that really I wrote over a 12-year stretch, I would say. So it helped, I don't know, it just helped bring it together for me, understanding the book. And it just gave a point for each poem.
And what was your, you know, you mentioned that the book took 12 years, you know, coming to fruition. What was your journey into poetry? I think you have a PhD in literature, right? Did you always intend to be a poet, or were you more interested in teaching and scholarship? How did that journey happen?
I definitely always wanted to be a writer. I've always sort of swung back and forth between poetry and fiction. And poetry just somehow always wins out. Like, I keep thinking, okay, I'll stop writing poems for a while and really focus on fiction, and then there's just always another poem. But I never wanted to be a scholar, and probably grad school was the wrong place to go, but I thought, well, it paid for me to read and have time to write for those 6 years or so. So that was the decision behind that. But it really... it took me in a different direction from what I wanted to go in ultimately. Although now I found my way back to teaching, but teaching reading as a writer, teaching from that point of view and teaching things that I want to learn about. So yeah, I feel more comfortable where I am now.
Well, do you want to read a couple more poems?
Sure. I thought I'd read Cemetery at White Point on page 28. And I can read the one right after, which is, I sort of think of them together, these two poems. The epigraph, so much of the earth that the earth does not feel their intrusion. João Cabral de Melo Neto. Passing over the crest, we've gone back in time, become unimaginable either way. So far removed, we can't feel our intrusion. Tire tracks everywhere scar the unfinished land, a craze of desire paths overgrown with grass. Less corrections to the rectilinear than errata. Any would lead to the point and yield a view of the blue-tinged North Mountains, Tenerife and Sugarloaf, silvered over. I pick out what is white, but it's not enough for a name. Heads of gulls dotting the farthest saddle of land, roots staving off erosion, feeding clusters of chickweed flowers, daisies, white clover with its spider-like mandibles, but also dandelions, harebells, blue flag. Round white granite stones studding the thin green sod, shorn where bedrock has collapsed into sea stacks. The cairn looks unreachable and we don't try. Clouds would be white and waves breaking on themselves in rough weather, fog gathering overnight, snow in its season, this a clear summer day. Rich white of the seagull breasts wheeling, keening, one bleeding like a sheep after something lost, leaving streaks of guano opaque to the light. Until we come to the solitary cross. 4 feet tall, the solid planks nailed together, at their crux a minuscule bronze crucifix, standing guard over a cordoned stretch of grass, as if it lay fallow or had just been sown. A cemetery, then, whose low hunchback stones, no different from the others strewn about, must mark graves of shipwrecked sailors or hold their place. Too little soil to cover a body here, even beneath the sole engraved stone, the words we stoop to glean, tomb of the unknown sailor, adding nothing, everything to what surrounds, like the brightest star in a constellation, nearer than the rest or immensely farther. Someone must come every few years to repaint what I knew at once to be the small white scratch we'd spied from the top of Tenerife Mountain, its name the Guanche words for mountain and white, an island people who forgot how to sail and sent young men off cliffs to speak with the dead, through your binoculars shaken by the wind.
Excellent. And that was Cemetery at White Point. And let's hear the Book of the Dead.
Book of the Dead, yeah. I scroll down through the news feed the way my parents comb obituaries, for the jolt of finding what I care about or want to show I do, by sending flowers, clicking like once enough nerve impulses fire. It has nothing to do with liking. It's like giving out change on the street, and over time I'm less giving, distrusting the habit I'm feeding in us both, how it inflates a currency untethered from memory, until I'm dismissive as one who's seen too much of those who've seen too little to align the telescope of need. As with each touch on its siphon, the sea slug withdraws her gills until nothing can move her except bodily. They'd have to pour their hearts out, risky as that is. What if no one likes it? Everyone agrees the book's a waste of time, but you have to ask yourself, if these are our lives, which is the waste? I scan each page anyway, ever since a friend died unnoticed, buried in my news feed for a year and a half. First gone missing for a week, then found in the Hudson, his glasses on shore. I know how he would have folded them, how his eyes looked newborn without them. They won't look at me anymore except in profile, the one that's been left up, so I can tell his ka I'm thinking of him, share my little news, my meals, answer that post I neglected, wish him a happy birthday the way we did in our last exchange, throwing Dante at each other, always reading too much into words. Nel mezzo del cammin, lasciate ogni speranza a sua madre. He doesn't like any of it. But his is the page I fall open to in this book of coming out into the light.
Yeah, and that was Book of the Dead from Time is Always Now. And it shows those poems that you've read so far show how rich I think your poems are. A lot of poets, I read a book a week now through this because we have this, which is great for me. I love it. And usually I don't read many poems twice. I just read through the book. But your poems are so rich that I found myself going back and rereading and sort of putting together the imagery, which moves around and braids through different places a lot. How do you go about constructing a poem? Are these built together, sort of condensed after many drafts? That's kind of how I was imagining it. But I don't know. What's your process like as a writer?
I mean, it's changed a little. I definitely am someone who has revised for a long, I revise things a lot. Though with the Poets Respond, I sort of had to jump me into a different mode. And it kind of comes pretty dense for me. And I try to winnow out a little, actually, or to space out, to space things out. I just think that's naturally how things, more things, like things just pull in more things. And it's, my effort is actually to try to space it out.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I'm sorry if they're still very dense.
No, they're dense in a good way, though. There's a richness and a beauty to the writing, and it moves through a lot of material. There's also these, we haven't gotten to it yet, but there are these poems that have different sections, and the sections move through different, sort of almost unrelated, not unrelated, but different characters and things. They move through different scenes that sort of relate to each other in a way that maybe the haiku and the haiga, or the prose part of a haiga, would fit together or something like that, where the connection is sort of metaphorical. Do they come out that way too? How do you determine like how long a poem is going to be, whether or not you're going to use sections like that? How do you approach it?
Yeah, it helps to think maybe of a particular poem. Sometimes if they're longer, they've usually taken longer. So I've had more time to try to understand what was drawing me to the material in the first place. And maybe because sometimes I write stories, they also tend to work in that way of just having more detail or, Louise Glick talks about poetry being autobiography without the detail. And sometimes I think, it still feels important to me sometimes, or it feels like it symbolizes something, and I'm working with that to actually understand something that happened.
Earlier you mentioned, writing fiction too. And Caitlin Buxbaum here says, that sounds like me trying to quit poetry for fiction all the time. And me too. I want to write fiction, and I always end up pulling it back into poetry, and I can't help it. Why do you think that is? Like, why are you drawn to poetry? Have you haven't published fiction books, have you?
Not books. Yeah, I have a collection of stories that I would
Mm-hmm.
like to. I've published a few individually.
So why do you find yourself being pulled toward poetry, though?
The easy answer would be that there's time for that. It feels like I can do that, that I need a longer stretch and more time to myself to do fiction. But I think there's something just about the concentration of it. I mean, poetry is concentrated, and I love that feeling of concentration in it and through it. And I think that's what keeps coming, bringing me back to it. And the form, the idea of form, somehow if I start writing, it just wants to be in lines, and then I want to think how many syllables or how many stresses or, there's something, I like numbers. And I think it just naturally kind of fall into that patterning that it can't do with fiction.
Well, if anybody has any questions for Rebecca Starks, just let me know in the chat windows. I'm watching Facebook and YouTube. I see Alex Pepple is here from Able Muse. Great to see. I just say I love Able Muse. It's probably you do great work. You're one of my favorite publishers for sure. So it's great to have you here. Do you want to read another poem?
Sure. I thought I'd read Parable of Two Sons on 76. I'm realizing I picked a lot of biblical imagery, and it's not it I'm not religious in any established sense, but the imagery has made its way into my life. Parable of Two Sons. Because no altar of the nightly news orients our unlocked cabin, just 4-point windows turning over the local rocks, the pileated woodpecker picking at stale sumac berries, a wild turkey family advancing their necks up over the hill, a sharp-shinned hawk clutching a snake. To prepare my sons for the wider world, at night I read them Bible stories, broadcast with modern facts and photographs. A ram's horn, threshing tools, fig cakes, the myrrh and makeup Esther likely used, mulberry, henna, kohl, to win favor for their people. And at the well, me with a nose ring like a cow's. Story after story, my firstborn shrugs off, knowing seas part in a tsunami, resurrection rouses from a deep sleep, a sandbar affords a path on water. Until he loses his footing, the waves close in and he falls silent at Stephen's stoning, John the Baptist's head, Jephthah's daughter's sacrifice. Meanwhile, his younger brother, favored, both have taken note, who for some months has asked for only one story, how we became people from wild apes, not fossil records and tectonic plates, but the turning, imaginal discs in their slip, stops asking why and sinks into the mystery of story. When in the story three times a child dies, each time he is restored to life by Samuel, by Elisha, by Jesus, I hear a release of breath, my son's breath that would clear the heavens.
And that was Parable of Two Sons, once again from Time Is Always Now. We haven't talked to many poets as guests on the Rattlecast who are editors too, and you're the founding editor of Mud Season Review. How long did you work directly on Mud Season Review? Because right now you're a consulting editor, right?
Yeah, I did for about 2.5 years, and I should say there were other. I mean, there was a co-founder with me of, and really we sort of all founded it together as a staff, starting from the Burlington Writers Workshop. So it was sort of something people decided to do on a whim, and someehow got appointed to be this editor in chief, and I had no idea what it entailed. So I have a sense of how much time it takes. And then we decided that everyone should just have a 2-year term. So once it kind of opened up, just to give way, like let other people in the workshop have that experience and work with it. And it was probably about time anyway. It takes a lot out of you. But I learned a ton.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. How has it affected your writing, having that experience reading submissions? Because I know it affects mine and Megan's a lot.
Yeah, I think it definitely did. I mean, I think I was very slow to understand writing as writing for an audience. I mean, I was really like recording, it was like recording my listening to the world. And it changes it to start understanding that you're writing to real people, and wow, a lot of people are writing that same kind of poem, or so you also react in that way too, of kind of feeling like that's not a new place to go, or yeah. That image you used is has been used many times before. So that was interesting. I found that I learned also that I loved editing, and it sort of helped me speed up my editing of my own poems.
Did you do a lot of hands-on editing when you were an editor at the Mud Season Review?
We found pretty quickly you could do that with fiction and nonfiction, but it's mm-hmm. really hard to do that with poetry, because there's some people who can take it and run, but a lot of people, or even, you know, I mean, probably myself too, if someone says that last part isn't working, they're just going to go and wreck it more. You know, you're no longer in that, you know, same place you were when you wrote the poem. You can't find it again. So.
Yeah, I completely feel the same way. We hardly ever have any kind of edits here. Like sometimes there's a line, I'll say this line doesn't work and we'll cut that line, or usually, or maybe the beginning or the end. Like a lot of times people have a opening stanza that there was sort of an intro that's not needed and it's better to jump right in, or sometimes they have an explanatory last stanza. But otherwise, we just, it's like a yum yuck. We just take what works, and for that same reason, because you can't expect them to come back and make it better. There's poems too. I don't know if you found this. Did you find that you could see where a poem had been workshopped too much? You can read and you can see like where the voice is sort of flowing in a natural, spontaneous way. And then you can see it changes and somebody all of a sudden, you know, you can say like, oh, this is where the workshop said you needed to do something different. And it's a different poem almost.
Yeah. That's interesting. I mean, I know that I've been told for short stories, like you should write it all in one sitting so that it's of a piece, even if you end up editing a lot, but you'd at least have that feeling of being of a piece. And I think a poem just needs that too. And I mean, one thing I've kind of come to late is also thinking that I don't revise as much. You know, I work on something a lot initially, and then it's either going to work or it's not. And I sometimes, you know, I'm quicker to give up on a piece mm-hmm. and think it's time to work on the next one, not this one.
Yeah, I'm the same way. Like I feel like there's a space that you sort of open. It's almost like a spiritual thing, like you're lighting candles or something, and then some and later your next book is Fetch Muse, so maybe you have feelings about this too, but I feel like you're opening up this special space, and like you can't step in the same river twice almost. So I feel like I have when I used to write a lot, I would write into the night and then just stay up until I finished, because I felt like if I went to bed, I couldn't get back into the same poem. It was gone.
Yeah.
And I was like a different person. And I could rewrite the poem. Like if it didn't work, I could go back and rewrite the poem in a different way, like start from scratch. But I couldn't do the same poem again. Do you find that too?
Yeah, I think so. And also just to keep open certain possibilities as long as possible. Like I've kind of learned to do that when I'm writing it, like not to make a choice about form early on, or just, I don't know, there's some way you can keep it open for longer where you're still in that gathering stage or something. And then there's the stage where it's going to whirl together or not, you know, mm-hmm. and then you've committed, you can't break out of that.
Yeah. I'm always fascinated because I talk to a lot of people who like feel like the work is in the revision, and I have no idea how they can function that way. I don't know how that works. You know, you can do line edits and stuff and fix little things, but I've never figured out how to work on pieces more than one day, really. Well, let's hear another poem. What do you want to do next?
Yeah, well, I can leave the Time Is Always Now and read the poem that's coming forthcoming in Rattle.
Sure, yeah. And this is this is going to be coming out in Rattle number 72 this June. So we're about to be working on that issue. And this is Paper Birches and Snow.
Yeah, okay. Paper Birches and Snow. Impossible to see the birches and not think white fragility, their thin skin and shallow roots making them first to topple with the thaw. Here a slant across the path, two caught easily in the crook of a red oak. Or of my uncle in Bowling Green crying in an argument no one was having, I have roots too, just as good and just as true. Or how a working class neighbor left her church once the minister spoke of white privilege. Everywhere the sodden white segments lie, ringed and knuckled black, and loosened scrolls of bark curl around coral yellow lining. Now that he's retired from the bank, my uncle spends his days rooting in genealogy, looking backward to what made him who he is. Mourning more than he did mother when she passed, his beloved dog curled by the fire.